there's explicit involvement of the native peoples on both sides in the decision-making process. The Russians haven't done business that way before.
Working out the details of the U.S.-Russia Polar Bear Treaty. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, July 28th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Congressman Young tries to convince his colleagues to limit federal enforcement in Yukon Charley Preserve.
Think about this very carefully. Do you want an agency that does not respect the rights of individuals?
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
the Doyon family of companies working together to build Alaska's future.
And by
AT&T, rethink possible. Details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
A federal wildlife biologist whose observation in 2004 of presumably drowned polar bears in the Arctic helped to galvanize the global warming movement has been placed on administrative leave and is being investigated for scientific misconduct, possibly over the veracity of that article. Charles Monette is an Anchorage-based scientist with the U.S. Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, Regulation, and Enforcement. He has not been informed by the Inspector General's Office of any charges or questions related to the scientific integrity of his work, according to Jeff Roush, Executive Director of Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility. Monette was told on July 18th that he was being put on leave pending results of an investigation into integrity issues. Roush's watchdog group plans to file a complaint on Monette's behalf. U.S. Fish and Wildlife officials are in Moscow this week to work out more details on the treaty for managing the polar bear population that roams between the U.S. and Russia. The treaty allows native groups on both sides of the Chukchi Sea to harvest bears for subsistence, but implementing that aspect of the treaty has been difficult. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
Since the Polar Bear Treaty was signed in 2000, things haven't gone exactly according to plan. But that doesn't seem to faze Rosa Meehan, head of the Marine Mammals Division of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Anchorage.
I mean, it's one thing for diplomats to get together in a room and sign a piece of paper. In fact, the hard work comes when you try and interpret what that piece of paper means so that it is a successful management strategy.
One of the main tenets of that management strategy is a legal subsistence harvest of the bears for native groups in Russia and Alaska that live on the Chukchi Sea. The harvest limit for both countries was set at 58 bears in 2010, but the quota still hasn't been implemented. Meehan says that's partly because the bilateral commission is breaking new ground in Russia.
The commission is made up of a federal commissioner and of a native commissioner. So there's explicit involvement of the native peoples on both sides in the decision-making process. The Russians haven't done business that way before.
Meehan wants natives in Chukotka to be able to harvest polar bears legally because illegal poaching there is such a big concern. She says poachers may harvest as many as 300 polar bears a year in Russia. That figure isn't sustainable for the population. But Meehan says a small subsistence take is, and she hopes a legal quota will give residents a reason to help keep the poaching in check.
You know, you're never going to get enough law enforcement present out in every place out there. Having people, the local people, invested in the management, part of the management, and having the management be transparent, we think is the best way to develop a general support for a legal harvest and an interest in maintaining it.
The Chukchi Sea polar bears appear to be doing well. Eric Regeer has been studying the population for 4 years. Each spring, he captures dozens of bears on the ice, takes samples, measurements, and weights, and then releases them. His data is still preliminary, but overall, he's been surprised at how healthy the bears seem.
They're in good body condition. They're pretty fat. We've also seen signs of really strong reproduction. So a lot of not only new cubs, but also yearlings and two-year-olds and then sub-adult bears that are being recruited, that are coming up into the adult population.
In the southern Beaufort Sea, it's a different story. Those bears are already suffering the effects of global warming. But the Chukchi Sea is a much more productive environment, and the bears appear to be benefiting from it. A bear Regeer studied last spring even set a new weight record for a polar bear captured for science. That male weighed in at 1,370 pounds. And Regeer says in the fall, it would have tipped the scales at 1,600 to 1,700 pounds.
It was a really neat thing for us to see. And as you can imagine, it was a a real challenge, because in order to know how, we knew that this was a large bear, but of course we collect a lot of information. We measure the bear, we take biological samples. We also have to weigh the bear. And so if you can picture two biologists out there 100 miles offshore on the frozen Chukchi Sea trying to physically weigh a polar bear that weighs almost 1,400 pounds, you know, it's a bit of a challenge, but it was definitely worth it and definitely interesting.
But the Chukchi Sea has experienced some of the largest sea ice loss in the Arctic, and so Regeer expects the polar bears there to suffer down the road when the sea ice has retreated so much the bears have no way to reach their seal prey. The U.S. wants to begin implementing the polar bear subsistence quota early next year. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
University of Alaska Fairbanks researchers are unlocking the secrets of hibernation. The studies are aimed at tapping the mechanism that safely slows down metabolism as a tool to save humans from heart attack and trauma. UAF neuroscientist Kelly Drew says a chemical in the brains of hibernating and non-hibernating animals has been identified as a trigger for a torpor state.
What we have found is that there's a molecule in the brain called adenosine, and that adenosine signals the onset of this bout of hibernation, and we can mimic that. We can induce it at will with an adenosine drug, a drug that stimulates adenosine receptors, and we can reverse it by blocking adenosine receptors with a drug like caffeine.
Drew and fellow UAF researcher Tulasi Jenka have been practicing on rats. Natural hibernators like bears and Arctic ground squirrels only go into the torpor state during the winter. Drew says experiments on Arctic ground squirrels have shown receptivity to adenosine has a seasonal element.
So this is novel in its own right, in that season has such influence on how our brains function. So what is changing the sensitivity to how the body responds to this neuromodulator with season is something of interest to us, particularly those who live in the north that are highly affected by season and might have other applications or implications for mental health and just adapting to our environment.
The next steps in Drew and Jinka's work probe how season increases receptivity to adenosine and whether artificially inducing the torpor state can increase survival of cardiac arrest. An article on their research is published in the July 26th edition of the journal Neuroscience. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a couple from Naknek is testing a new use for abundant waste in Alaska.
There's fish waste in almost every village all over the state.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
We all need energy to power our homes and businesses. Tapping renewable energy sources like wind, geothermal, and hydro helps keep our economy local, creating jobs, revenue, and power for the state. Learn more at realaska.org. This message sponsored by Renewable Energy Alaska Project, committed to creating a sustainable economic future for Alaska.
A bill before the U.S. House would strip away National Park Service power to enforce regulations on the waters of the Yukon-Charlie Preserve in the interior. Congressman Don Young says it's the first volley in a battle over who rules Alaska's waterways. Young inserted language into a funding bill now being voted on in the House. He did so in response to what interior Alaskans call heavy-handed treatment by park rangers. Young's anti-Park Service provision wasn't popular among Democrats, and Representative Norm Dix of Washington State floated an amendment to get Young's issue stripped from the bill.
You know, we have people in the law enforcement area who make mistakes. Well, we don't get rid of law enforcement. We don't say we're no longer going to protect people, the other people.
Democrats also complained because Young inserted a local pet issues line into a national appropriations bill. But Young fought back, and yesterday evening, Dick's amendment was defeated, and Young's language against the Park Service remained.
Think about this very carefully. Do you want an agency that does not respect the rights of individuals because they work for the government? Does not respect the rights of history? I don't think you do. So I'm asking the amendment to be defeated and asking for my colleagues to understand this is a big issue in my state. It's very, very important, not only to me, but to my people, the people of the state of Alaska that have been using that river for centuries.
The Republican-dominated House supported Young's issue, including Congressman Mike Simpson of Idaho.
The problem is you say you're trying to save Mr. Young from himself by offering this amendment. We're trying to save the Park Service from itself and the actions that it's taken.
Debate on the floor heated up as Congressman Dix and Young sparred over who would have jurisdiction on the Alaska waters, the Coast Guard or the state.
How does the Coast Guard have jurisdiction? That's another federal agency. The gentleman changed his story down in the gym and
will
told
you yield?
Me that
wait
it was the state that had authority.
Will you yield?
I would wonder who in the hell has authority.
Well, you're from Washington. You don't know who has navigational.
I don't have the time.
You don't know how.
Yes. Again, the chair requests that members use the proper yielding to each other for time. The time's controlled by the gentleman from Virginia.
Despite their shouting, Young and Dix have served together for decades and were periodically laughing as the other spoke. The fight between the Park Service and Alaskans who live near the Yukon Charley Preserve is no laughing matter, though. It hit a fever pitch last fall when a 70-year-old man from Central was charged after a scuffle with park rangers who tried to do a boat safety check on the Yukon River. A decision is pending in that case. The people of Lake and Peninsula Borough will get to vote on a ballot measure that would prohibit mining projects that ruin salmon streams. A judge decided to allow the vote and decide later about whether such a decision is within the power of an initiative or needs to be made by government. Dacia Eaton of member station KDLG reports from Dillingham.
Judge John Suddick has issued a decision in the case of the Pebble Limited Partnership versus the Lake and Peninsula Borough. The case revolved around a citizens' initiative aimed at protecting salmon and salmon habitat from the development of Pebble Mine. Lamar Cotton is the borough manager. He says the borough's pleased that the voters' voices will be heard.
Our decision to hold the election was upheld by the judge, and we're satisfied with that. As for the judge making a decision to hold off on any of the summary judgment motions until after the election, I guess we'll just wait and see how it unfolds from there.
The SOS initiative was proposed by the citizen group Alaskans for Bristol Bay, who gathered more than 300 signatures in support of getting it on the ballot. The initiative would amend the borough's development permitting code to prevent the development of any large-scale resource extraction activity, including mining, which would destroy or degrade salmon habitat. The effort by the citizens in the Lake and Peninsula Borough is just the latest in several attempts to stop or slow down development of the Pebble deposit. Those attempts included a statewide voter initiative that was rejected and the recent request by several tribal and fishing entities to have the EPA step in and preemptively use its veto authority under the Clean Water Act. In his ruling, Judge Suddick basically said that although zoning matters are usually not decided by initiative, he would not rule against the SOS initiative. The reason, past cases that ruled against zoning by initiative involved only general law municipalities and boroughs, but not home rule boroughs, such as Lake and Penn. Under the Alaska Constitution, home rule boroughs have more power than municipalities and boroughs. Mike Heatwell, Vice President of Public Affairs for the Pebble Partnership, says the partnership is weighing its options.
It remains our belief that it's a poorly worded initiative, presents bad public policy, and it really is in conflict with the state's ability to manage its resources.
The Lake and Peninsula Borough is pushing ahead with plans for the initiative to appear on the municipal election ballot this fall. The vote is slated for Tuesday, October 4th. In Dillingham, I'm Dacia Eaton.
The Anchorage economy in 2011 is growing, and that's a trend likely to continue through 2014. The Anchorage Economic Development Corporation also says some sectors are actually stronger than expected. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
In January, the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation offers its annual forecast of the city's economic health for the upcoming year. In July, it traditionally offers a mid-year adjustment. That forecast tweaking took place yesterday during an AEDC luncheon at the Denina Convention and Civic Center. Bill Popp, president and CEO of the nonprofit corporation, told over 1,000 attendees that so far, overall, new job creation was a little stronger than anticipated.
Average employment through June was 1,300 jobs higher than the same 6 months in 2010. AEDC is now revising its projection to 1,400 additional jobs in 2011, up 300 from our original projection earlier this year.
Once again, Anchorage's healthcare sector continued as the pace setter in new jobs. That's an industry trend that continued even during 2009, when all but two sectors of the Anchorage economy lost jobs. Pop said AEDC and the McDowell Group, which works with the corporation to develop the forecasts, had thought that in 2011, healthcare would begin slowing down. They were wrong.
We projected 300 jobs in 2011, and now that looks to be significantly on the low side based on preliminary numbers through the first 6 months of the year. Average job counts for that period were 750 higher than the same 6 months in 2010. So for healthcare, we still haven't seen the end in growth, and we don't know when it's going to come.
Two other sectors of the Anchorage economy showing more job growth than predicted: professional and business services up 500, leisure and hospitality up 400 jobs. On the negative side, oil employment in Anchorage has dropped slightly so far in 2011. AEDC had predicted no net change this year. However, Pop said the 100 local job drop was an exception.
Now, statewide, and this is an important indicator, oil and gas employment is up approximately, 800 jobs through the first 6 months of 2011 for an average of 13,100 workers. Now, this is an important economic indicator for our region, as 58% of Alaska's oil and gas workforce live in Anchorage, the Kenai Peninsula, and the Mat-Su Valley.
Construction employment in Anchorage remains flat so far in 2011. Pop says after declining job numbers since 2007, that's actually good news for the local construction industry. Government jobs in the city through May are down by 300, and retail has lost 100 jobs. Besides 2011 adjustments, Pop also offered a three-year forecast. He said signs of a slowdown in the national recovery has caused AEDC to temper its previous three-year vision. Still, buoyed by high oil prices, the overall picture remains positive.
Alaska and Anchorage are still in a position of relative economic strength, and modest growth is forecasted in all eight indicators.
Those indicators for Anchorage include 3 years of expected population growth to approximately 309,000 residents by 2014, annual employment growth between 1 and 1.5%, personal income growth from 4 to 5%, air passenger and cargo growth, an increase in city building permit values through 2014, continued slow growth in freight volume at the Port of Anchorage, and fairly stable oil prices of over $100 a barrel. Two influential unknowns, according to Pop, are the impact on Alaska of expected federal budget reductions and declining oil production. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
And by
NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com.
The international waters of the high Arctic are a new horizon for human activity. That was the driving force between an Arctic Ocean Policy workshop this week in Fairbanks. University of Alaska Fairbanks professors and counterparts from a Canadian university organized the event, which focused on the Central Arctic, or Donut Hole, outside the 200-mile zone along national boundaries. UAF Geography and Arctic Policy professor Lawson Brigham says there's growing interest in the global commons of the high Arctic.
People are beginning to think about maybe fishing up in higher latitudes. They're beginning to think about prospecting on the seabed. They're looking for oil and gas in the Arctic Ocean. And of course, the other issue is people believe that there might be shipping, large ships crossing the top of the world rather than going along the coasts of Russia, along the coasts through the Northwest Passage. So there's a lot more attention today on this very remote region.
Brigham is a former icebreaker captain and chair of an Arctic marine shipping assessment. He says secondary to economics, climate change and the retreat of sea ice are helping foster interest in the Central Arctic. He says impending use and development are being paralleled by an international push to regulate and protect the area. 60 people from 12 countries participated in this week's Arctic workshop in Fairbanks. UAF Vice Chancellor and Geography Department Director Mike Sfraga says the conference as part of the university's effort to be a leader in Arctic research.
As America's Arctic University, we should influence not only science agendas, economic discussions, but we should influence the future of the Arctic because it impacts Alaskans. And we should, I believe, do it from an Alaskan perspective. And so since we represent the United States as its Arctic territory, UAF's perspective is we should be intimately engaged in the global dialogue.
Sfraga says UAF infrastructure like the new Arctic research vessel under construction and faculty with Arctic expertise position the university to be a player as interest in the polar region increases. In Alaska, fish is an important component of daily life. As a form of food, the base of the seafood harvesting and processing industry, and the target of a sport fishing tourism industry. But a few pioneers are testing out whether it might be a perfect supplement to farming in the state. KDLG's Melody Kay has the details.
Off a dirt road behind the Alaska General Seafoods freezer plant in Naknek, there's a 20 by 10 foot PVC structure wrapped in plastic. This is Naknek Family Seafoods owner and manager Izetta Chambers' farm, but also her experimental solution for disposing of the guts and other fish waste from her small processing plant.
What do they say? Necessity is the mother of invention. When we were going for our fish processing license with DEC, we had put on our license that we were going to use the City Dock fish grinder. One of the wastewater guys came back and said, no, you can't list that because the Bristol Bay Borough hasn't had an active NPDES permit, National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System permit, since 1994. This was a couple of years back. And so we listed land application on our permit.
A plan born out of necessity, the farm has bore fruit, literally, in the form of cherry tomatoes so far. And looking at Chambers' four rows of salad greens and bush beans, perhaps some other vegetables presently as well. Chambers has tried fish compost, which is a mix of soil, peat, and fish waste, and liquid fish, essentially ground fish mixed with water, and commercially purchased efficient microbes inoculants to further break down the solution. Chambers isn't alone with her fish fertilizer idea either. Kenai-based Snug Harbor Seafoods and Ninilchik-based Anchor Point Seafoods both sell fishy peat or compost made from fish waste at their processing plants. In Homer, there's at least a couple of farms that compost fish and surround their plots with electric fences for bear-proofing. And in the early 2000s, the Sitka tribe had a fish and wood chip compost operation that utilized whole fish waste from the Japan-bound roe industry. Jody Anderson is a University of Alaska Fairbanks instructor and program director of the Alaska Community Horticulture Program. She says that farming with fish makes sense in a state with so many poor soil locations and shouldn't just be a commercial venture or byproduct.
There's fish waste in almost every village all over the state, and not saying that we should no longer put our fish waste back into the rivers, because I feel like that's really beneficial to the river ecosystem as well, but possibly diverting some of that fish waste back onto the soil is a really great local resource that can be used that's free. It doesn't cost any money to ship it in, and it can be used directly to improve local soil.
Anderson explains that fish are a balanced, complete source for potassium, phosphorus, and micronutrients, all elements that make up good gardening soil. Plus, she says, fish decomposes really rapidly in Alaskan soil. In her recent research, Anderson found that just putting fish heads alone in soil is very beneficial.
Our soil is very nitrogen poor, for the most part. Most of the soil in Alaska is. And so fish is very high nitrogen. And so the bacteria that live in the soil naturally are very excited when they get this much nitrogen into the soil, and so the microbes are using that nitrogen very quickly.
However, in a community with a lot of bears like Naknek, Chamber says she likes fish compost better. Liquid fish is smelly and hard to deal with.
You can see my barrel out there, then you can see where the bear squeezed it, and it's kind of hard to maneuver now.
Anderson said that electric fences are a relatively cheap way to keep bears out. Plus, she says that compost odor can be controlled with carbon content. Anderson says that covering a compost pile in 6 to 8 inches of carbon, whether it be ground wood chips or sawdust, also hides the pile from birds and creates what she calls a biofilter.
So what it does is that carbon actually will act like Velcro to the odor that comes out. They're organic molecules that the odor is, and they actually cling to, they get stuck to that carbon that's capping the pile, and you don't end up with the smell as bad.
Lassie horticulturist Anderson reassures interested gardeners that composting with fish, if done right, doesn't make your vegetables taste like fish or even make your garden smell like fish.
It's just like compost that you might make with your banana peels and eggshells and coffee grounds and newspapers. You don't end up in your garden tasting newspaper and banana skins and eggshells.
And Chamber's 3-year-old daughter, Lavina, agrees. Back in their family's experimental farm in Naknek, Lavina tries a cherry tomato. When I ask if it tastes like fish, she shakes her head vigorously and puts on her gardening gloves, the better to help her mother with watering. Reporting in Naknek, this is Maladi Kay.
The first fall chums are heading up to the Yukon River. Alaska Department of Fish and Game biologist Jeff Estenson says the run, which began on the lower Yukon last week, is expected to be stronger than recent years.
We're looking at about 750,000 fish right now. And at that level of abundance, that would be sufficient to meet our escapement needs drainage-wide. And this is to include our Canadian border obligation, and this would also provide for subsistence and allow for commercial opportunity.
Estenson says the fall chum run is below average, but better than 2009 and 10, when it was around 500,000 fish. He says there's a strong correlation between summer and fall chum runs on the Yukon, and the summer run was relatively strong. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Dacia Eaton and Melody Kay in Dillingham, and Len Anderson in Anchorage. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com. Timing is everything. A mother who waits until her child is at least 2 years old before becoming pregnant again is making the best decision for herself and her baby. The mother has a better chance of regaining health and energy between pregnancies, and her baby has a better chance of being born on time and at a good weight. Talk to your health care provider to find out how to plan your pregnancies. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. How do you get men to wear their life jacket when the fact is that 90% of boating-related fatalities in Alaska are men? Well, truthfully, most men won't listen to messages like this, but they might listen to you. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card and make a promise to wear their life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time! Get a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back alive. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.